Hello. Good morning.
Hello, Kill Radio.
Hi, Bennett's here with Chris Burnett.
Hey, Bennett.
We've mostly been discussing all this stuff by email. And, well, here it is, the 6th anniversary of September 11th. At least the sort of heavy religious aspects of 9/11 seem to have finally boiled away.
And that's definitely a good sign.
Oh, God. I was sick of that stuff. I mean, even they've even moved where they have this the memorial in New York to a different location. It's in some park downtown rather than near Ground Zero.
Well, now we live in a homeland. Who would have thought?
Homeland insecurity here. Everybody who listens to Kill has heard a lot of what I've had to say. I don't know how do I introduce this. I'm really interested in evidence. I've spent a lot of time going over the 9/11 websites, and I've read a couple of the books, and I've read a lot of articles, and I'm not too convinced. And
which book did you read, by the way?
I read one that what's it called? 9/11 Questions that I bought at a newsstand in Hollywood. And
do you know the author?
No, I'm sorry. This was actually 2 years ago or something like that. And but I have spent time. I mean, as I told you the other day, I listened to David Ray Griffin, who I respect as a man. I mean, he's an interesting, intelligent person, and his theologian stuff is actually pretty interesting. I listened to him debunk the debunkers. That's his new book.
Yeah, 9/11 debunking 9/11 debunking.
Are you a fan of David Ray Griffin?
I think, I really like him. I think I haven't read his books, so I'm probably not the best person to comment on his work necessarily, because I've we've gone back and forth a lot on this. And for the listeners out there, my position is that I do believe it was an inside job, and I would primarily take a viewpoint from the science angle, and I'm mostly paying attention to all the work that the engineers and the physicists and chemists are doing. And just to give people a heads up who are interested, if they want to follow up more, a lot of the material that I rely on comes from a website called journalof911studies.com. Mm-hmm. So journalof911studies.com, it's a peer-reviewed scientific journal, which means that papers do not get published there without other scientists reviewing the work, so that it's not a free-for-all. And so all the papers that are up there do get reviewed by peers. Like, so if you're a PhD scientist and a physicist, then another PhD physicist will review that work, and then before it gets published. And peer review is the standard protocol for any kind of journal of science. So they're doing this online, but it's a public forum, or it's publicly accessible.
Oh, it's totally available. Yeah, it's there. And this is the 9/11 Scholars.
This is the group called Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. And actually, there was a breakoff between a previous group headed by Jim Fetzer, and Stephen Jones and Jim Fetzer had a very different attitude towards the way they approached this work. So they split, and then one group became Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, which is Dr. Jones's site.
Okay. Well, what do you I don't want to be belligerent or anything, but I haven't found the stuff compelling. So what is it that you found compelling?
Well, the evidence to me right now is overwhelming. And I think what we have to do is there's so much to talk about, and there's a lot of the details matter. Where to begin? I think the first thing that really caught my eye was Building 7. Listeners should know that to this date, 6 years later, there is not official government position on what happened with Building 7. They actually contracted out to a private group recently, and the private group has not come back with their explanation for how Building 7 fell. What they did was is they proposed a number of hypotheses, and they said the one hypothesis that they proposed, and this was in the FEMA report, NIST hasn't actually dealt with this. And by the way, NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. FEMA came up with a scenario which they themselves called a very low probability of occurrence. And basically what that was is that they had this whole elaborate jet fuel issue where jet fuel would melt the steel and then the building would come down. But they even themselves have said, again, it's a low probability of occurrence, and we can get into what they actually said.
Well, no jet fuel hit Building 7.
Yeah, no plane hit Building 7. A lot of people don't even know this. And that when I first saw Building 7, I was an eye-opener. And I think if you haven't seen Building 7 fall, you should go. You can watch it on a number of sites, but I would direct people to journalof911studies.com.
Okay.
And there's a beginner section there. You can watch it come down. So Building 7 to me was the clincher. And so to this date, 6 years later, the government has not officially given their explanation for Building 7. they have said they came up with a couple ideas. But a lot of them have been discredited by a number of scientists who said, you know, again, them themselves have said that it's a low probability of occurrence. But their idea is jet fuel and, you know, et cetera. But we have to realize that for the first time in history, three buildings came down allegedly due to fire on a steel frame building. And that has never happened since 9/11 or before 9/11. And what the official story stands is that somehow fire has melted steel. But we have dozens and dozens of examples of buildings standing for 24 hours on you know, an inferno and not coming down due to structural failure. I don't know if you listen. I did an interview with Kevin Ryan, who is one of the co-editors of the journal 911studies.com. He was a chemist who worked at Underwriters Laboratories, and he was fired for challenging and asking questions about their report to NIST. NIST actually took floor assemblies and set them up and burned them in a controlled environment for 2 hours, and they saw maybe 3 inches of sag, but no serious structural fit, no serious like melting of the steel. And this is what a lot of people who've actually read the NIST report and a lot of the scientists are saying, and is that NIST came out, they ignored their result. They said it sagged 3 inches, when in fact in their final conclusion they said it sagged 41 inches. But there was no serious damage to the structures, because Kevin Ryan worked for the company that certified the steel. And when they actually did these tests, they didn't get the result that they wanted. So the whole thing about NIST, and I have a clip I'd rather just play for Kevin talking about it, because he's articulate.
Fine. Absolutely.
It's about 8 minutes, but we can keep talking about some of this stuff. So anyways, Building 7 has all the characteristics of controlled demolition. Me and you have been going back and forth, and you raised a point that controlled demolition companies in this country, there's not many that have come out and even commented on Building 7, and there may have been a few that have.
The only ones that David Ray Griffin mentioned in his debunking talk were European people who saw videos.
Right. So the video, there was a guy, a Dutch demolition expert, who when
that
he first
was one,
saw it,
yeah.
He said it's standard controlled demolition by the way it fell, because it starts from the bottom and has the kink in the middle. But the key issue about Building 7, it has the main thing that fire would never do, and I actually talked about this with Dr. Frank Legge. He's a PhD chemist. I interviewed him yesterday on KPFK. He was saying, you know, just think about it for a second. Even if the fires were to melt the steel in the Building 7, it would be on the south side, because that's where the few fires that were, they're very minimal. And all the cold steel is on the north side of the building. And you have this, for the sake of the argument, let's play it out. Even if fire were to melt the steel on the south side, you would have bending, you would have sort of a not immediate structural failure. You probably have slow failure or any kind of bending or warping that the center of gravity would move towards the left side. And then you would probably have a collapse that would tend towards the south, and then the building would slowly fall and go into the street. But we didn't see that at all on Building 7. It came had universal symmetric failure, meaning that there are 81 columns in that building, very strong steel columns. We saw that building come straight down in its footprint, and with the classic characteristics of controlled demolition, which is that it starts in the middle and a kink at the top, blown from the bottom, and then it has squibs all the way up and down the left and right side, which is a very standard characteristic for controlled demolition. And there's a number of these exercises that go on and do this on a lot of the papers at the Journal of 911studies.com. But anyways, that's Building 7. There's a lot even more to talk about with that. But then there's the Twin Towers, and then we have forensic evidence. The forensic evidence, to me, is the strongest piece of evidence that we have that Dr. Jones participated in his work. And he has the paper. He covers it in Applying the Scientific Method on the Journal of 9/11 Studies. So there's that issue, too.
What was the question? David Ray Griffin brought up, and Brent Blanchard, who's a controlled demolition expert who independently did do a study of the collapse of the towers and Building 7. They both talk about a chain of evidence issue with Dr. Jones regarding the thermate residue that he claimed to have found. Do you know anything about the chain of evidence issue?
Yeah, well, a lot of people at first when they were attacking Dr. Jones, they said, well, you know, they tried to claim that thermite might have been present in the cutting of the steel when they were cleaning up, but there's no evidence for that, and it would be a foolish thing to do anyways. That's never been done before, because thermite is a high explosive, and it's
no, thermite, as far as my understanding is, it's a slow burning.
No, it's actually not when it's
well.
We
got to separate thermite from thermate.
Yeah,
thermite is a slow burning a chemical. Thermate is different.
Yeah, because the high explosive you can actually make thermate into a high explosive, and this was demonstrated on a number of sites actually where the patent is for actually doing this. But when you add different elements such as sulfur, you lower the reaction itself. It's what's called highly exothermic, which means it releases a lot of energy. And it also, by adding sulfur, it's more efficient, and it lowers the melting point of steel. That's a characteristic of thermate. But anyways, back to the point of the residue. The residue didn't come from the ground, by the way. It came from the third floor of this woman's apartment, and there's photographs of the apartment and the dust, and she saved that dust. And then Dr. Jones went out there with other scientists in order to have witnesses and look at the dust sample that she collected. And they got the sample, and then he did the analysis on it. And then the key thing about that dust sample, which is very important, when he went through it with a magnet, he pulled out all the iron-rich microspheres, right? Just the fact that this iron substance was in a circular shape that was hollow in the middle is evidence for the fact that the steel was molten at one point. And in order to melt steel, you need to get above 1,500 degrees Celsius.
It's 2,750 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah. And NIST's own reports, they actually had about 200 samples left over from the World Trade Center. Mind you, the stuff disappeared and was sent off to China. God knows why. There was no real investigation in a standard forensic investigation of a crime scene. But we'll put that aside for a second. I think that's more of the circumstantial evidence, where you have a lot of weird shit going on in 9/11 where the steel just disappeared. But they kept 200 samples. They did, and only 2% of the samples that NIST showed on the steel reached temperatures high enough of like 250 degrees Celsius. None of them were close to the melting point of steel, which is 1,500 degrees Celsius. Aluminum, by the way, melts at 600 degrees Celsius. There's a lot of issues around aluminum. But anyways, back to the iron-rich microspheres, just the fact that they're circular indicates that at one point they were molten or liquefied. You can't get those temperatures without some highly a high-temperature reaction like thermate. It's like the same thing. When you throw water up in the air, it creates little balls. It's called surface tension, and the surface tension causes the water to form into a circle, into a ball. It's the same principle. When you liquefy something like iron and it's flying through the air, the surface tension tends to create these little balls. So just the fact that you have these iron-rich microspheres in these spheres themselves indicate liquefaction and then solidification after, you know, and then the surface tension causing the sphere to form. Okay, and then let's look at what they did with the microspheres. They went in and analyzed the content of the iron. They used what's called XEDS, which is an X-ray energy dispersive spectroscopy. Spectroscopy is a way of analyzing samples for their elements. So, for example, they took the iron-rich microspheres, put it into the system, XEDS, and they looked at the elements. And what they found was that you found iron, you found manganese, potassium, and sulfur. All of those are characteristics of a thermate reaction. And you can actually Google this. This is a standard test that fire authorities will use to determine if thermate or thermite was used in arson. So it's a very standard test that's used to determine the presence of thermite or thermate. Thermate is the presence of sulfur, by the way. So what we have strong forensic evidence for the presence of thermate. And Dr. Jones has published this paper, and you can see his graphs, and you can see the percentages of each of these. But normally you would never find potassium or sulfur, or manganese for that matter, in this kind of metal. It just wouldn't exist in the steel by itself. And remember that the steel has iron in it, but you know it's composed of other elements, but certainly not manganese and certainly not sulfur. So just that presence alone is the signature for a thermate reaction.
And there's no other way that this could appear?
No, there isn't. That's a question I actually asked or wrote to Kevin Ryan, and I wanted to follow up on that as well because I think I asked him that in my last interview. Uh-huh. You know, could the sulfur have been there prior to when the buildings were built? And he said, absolutely not. And he is an expert in the steel because he worked for the company that certified the steel.
Okay.
So we have very strong evidence for the presence of thermate. There's also another company that actually did test some of the metal. And the New York Times called this one of the biggest mysteries of 9/11 is the presence of this sulfur. But they never pursued it. But there is another company, and I don't remember the name off the top of my head,
okay,
that actually did do some sample studies. And Dr. Jones contacted the original scientist, and he said, yeah, found this in there. But they never pursued it because it never even occurred to them, the possibility. You know, the original story was taken sort of at a point when everybody was very sensitive, when they're under shock therapy, essentially, right? We're all like, oh my God, something happened. People are under those conditions are very open to suggestion, and we all were, I think. And I certainly was. And you're like, all right, I guess it's a fire, you know? And then over the years, that fades away, and people begin to look very critically at the evidence. But there was other scientists who did study and found the sulfur. And there is an article in the New York Times saying this is one of the biggest mysteries of 9/11.
I imagine there are a lot of mysteries in 9/11. Just as a point, the interim report has been an interim report that you said was farmed out to somebody else, but it has been released by NIST, and that was done in 2005. I sent it to you.
Not on Building 7, though. Maybe
no. It's the whole report is about Building 7. Yes, you are absolutely correct. They have not determined exactly what caused the fall of the building, but they have made educated guesses.
Well, I the thing that you sent me, I did read, and they did say at the end of the report that these are all hypotheses that need to be tested. And they were ideas that they had, but I would disagree that they were looking. I think they were avoiding some of the best evidence for the presence of explosives and molten metal. By the way,
the Protec controlled demolition expert Brent Blanchard did a brief analysis to answer some of these questions. He also says he has no idea what exactly caused the building to fall, but he also claims that in all the years since, there's been no solid evidence presented to him that showed, and not anything, not a piece of a blasting cap, not a piece of cording, nothing like that, that indicates to him a controlled demolition. Plus, as an expert, he doesn't think it looked like controlled demolition. When I look at the fall of Building 7, it does seem to fall forward on the south side, the side that was facing in towards the rest of the World Trade Center, and the collapse. Yes, it's very quick. It comes right down.
It comes down in 6.5 seconds. And that is and I think you are I would have to disagree with that statement. I think there's a lot of people who recognize it as controlled see it as controlled demolition. Just the fact you have to realize that there's 81 core columns in this giant building and they're all interlaced and connected together. Fire has never brought down a building in history ever. And not since and not before.
Well, then, may I ask one thing, though? Yeah. Why do they fireproof steel if fire doesn't melt steel?
They fireproof steel in order to give it apparently to give more protection than it actually probably needs. There's probably laws on the books about fireproofing it, but they do that in order to give it longer lasting. And actually, in my clip, Kevin Ryan talks about the problems with fireproofing in the NIST report and how their theory they had to drop because they weren't getting the results they expected. But so never before in history has a building fall because of fire. Building 7 was not hit by a plane. There were, if you've seen the pictures of it, there's like three floors with very small fires on it. And this is a very,
yeah,
very...
But also the whole front of the building was smashed in.
Well, not the whole front. It was actually a corner, and it was maybe about five floors that were damaged.
More like 10.
Well, okay. But it's an 80-story building or something. It's a very
a
tall building. It's a
47-story
building. 47, right. Yeah. It's a tall building. A very small amount of fires. And even still, like, again, this stuff is interlaced with 81 core columns in there.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know, even if you damage three or four of those columns, you still have got 75. Let's even say they damaged 10, which is... There's no evidence for that. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, there's 70 core columns still standing. This stuff is interlaced. Fire does not reach temperatures to melt steel. We know there's really good scientific studies that the highest temperature that hydrocarbon fires under the best conditions, diffused hydrocarbon fires can reach is 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't know what the numbers are in Celsius. I usually think in Celsius, but... They're not high enough to even get near melting steel.
Well, but it's not about melting steel. It's about
weakening
it to the point where it loses
right.
the support
there's
of
no,
what's above it.
Right, and there's no evidence for that to happen. There's not any evidence that the steel – and again, NIST did this in my clip.
Uh-huh.
Kevin talks about them actually doing this for 2 hours using hydrocarbon fires. No weakening whatsoever. A small sag of 3 inches. It's not going to – and when you're talking about an interlaced building – and this and remember, the fires on the Twin Towers burned for maybe like 20 minutes, the big balls of fire. Then the thing comes down in an hour. We have evidence – the NIST own study for 2 hours did not weaken the steel. And there's no building in history that's ever come down because of fire. And hydrocarbon fires will not melt steel. But back to the point of the Building 7, you've got it's a south corner – even if – let's just for the sake of argument say that you could melt steel and you have it in the south corner of Building 7, right? That part, theoretically, let's say, it comes weak. But you've got to realize it's cold steel. It's all interlaced, very strong, 81 core columns. On the north side, still strong as hell and cold. And the one of the features of steel, by the way, it's very an excellent conductor of heat. So even if you melt or heat up one area of steel – it diffuses through that steel and it easily takes a long – that's one reason it takes forever to do any damage to steel. I mean, you probably have to run the thing for days in order to do any damage because steel is a very great conductor of heat and it'll just transfer that heat throughout the other parts of the building and diffuse that area and not and maintain its strength.
Well, there were reports at 3 o'clock. It came down right around
5:20.
There were reports by 3 p.m. on September 11th that they knew the building was going to fall.
Right. Well, that's a lot of people feel that that's because whoever knew, in my view, they had planted explosives in that building were giving people a warning. There were no firefighters in there. They
right.
pulled
there were
all
no
the
casualties,
fire.
Fortunately.
Yeah. They pulled everybody out. But back to my little exercise. And a lot of these things are at journalof911studies.com, and actually far more involve sort of math and science stuff. Gordon Ross is a mechanical engineer, has done a lot of math on the WTC Twin Towers, which people can read, and if there's scientists out there, they can take a look at it. None of these have been challenged, by the way, in the scientific community. They still stand as strong papers. But let's go back to our exercise of Building 7. Even if you were to sort of weaken the south side of the tower, you'd expect it to sort of bend on those floors and go, okay, three or four floors are, like, done, right? And they go, they lose all their strength. Okay, maybe it'll bend over to that side a little bit. But you've got to realize the other side of the tower is still intact, strong. It's not going to necessarily give away, but let's say it does. You would expect the building to go sort of bend towards the south and maybe find some weakness. But no, there wasn't even a pancake on Building 7. The thing exploded just like – you could see explosions when the thing came down. And again, 6.5 seconds, universal failure of 81 columns across the entire building – bam, like that, straight down. Even if the south side was even a little bit like weakened, you'd expect it to go like bend over. Mm-hmm. That's one that, you know, that's just a mental exercise that's, you know, that's good to think about. The Twin Towers themselves were a very different beast in the way that they were brought down. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and play that. That would be fine with me.
Well, I just want to point out one thing here, that this is the latest paper, Dr. Frank Legge. I did the interview with him yesterday. I want to read something that he wrote, which I think is a very good exercise for people to consider. Let's see. I think it's right here. Okay. He says... He points out there's three papers that were that are at the Journal of 9/11 Studies and a number of scientists have worked on. These three papers taken together have not been challenged, and they still stand because nobody's been able to say that the science is bad or anything like that. So he points out three papers. One is by Gordon Ross, who's a mechanical engineer. The other is by a mathematician named Kettler, I believe. And the third is Nis' own study. And he says... taking these three papers together, we have evidence that the collapse, A, could not have initiated. These are the Twin Towers. A, could not have initiated. B, if it initiated, it could not have continued. And C, if it continued, it could not have been as fast as observed, which was about 9.6 seconds. And those are really three important points. Any of those points could not have initiated. If it initiated, it could not have continued. And if it continued, it could not have moved as fast as it did. Any of those challenge the official story of the fire-induced collapse. And I encourage listeners to go to Dr. Jones's paper called Applying the Scientific Method. On page 13, you will see a visualization. And I think this helps people who aren't scientists, who aren't like looking at all the numbers and blah, 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 don't get that stuff, which is... but this exercise has been very helpful for a lot of people, including myself. I think it was... when I saw it, I'm like, holy shit. Basically, imagine the top 14 floors of the building, right? In one picture, just hanging there from a rope, like I'm holding it, right? With nothing underneath it. So I'm holding the top 14 stories of the North Tower. Okay, and there's nothing underneath it. If I drop that, that thing would come straight down. Now imagine a picture with me holding the 14 stories, and below it is the entire building, right? Now, what we are led to believe by the official story... is that if I drop either one of these, they'll come down at the exact same time. So if I hold the thing 14 stories with my hand and I drop it, it'll come down in about 10 seconds. That's about free fall speed. Now imagine you drop it and you have the rest of the 100 floors or whatever it is. It'll, according to the official story, that building will basically collapse. Cold steel, very solid cores. 47 core building, and I would drop it, it would come down in 10 seconds. That's what they're asking us to believe, which is absolutely absurd. When you actually do the calculations, like all this material in this building is actually, we're losing about 10 floors a second. We are losing 10 floors every second in the collapse that we saw. How do you lose 10 floors in a second? There should be some. It violates the conservation of momentum, a fundamental law of physics, and this has gone into in a number of these papers. How do you move out 10 floors in 1 second out of the way when you have 14 floors, which compare the mass of the 14 floors to the 100 or so floors? Major difference. Major difference. I mean, I don't know what the numbers are, but that thing, that bottom building is not just going to move, like, give away at 10 floors every second. There had to be something moving the mass out of the way. On top of that, all the building was pulverized into dust, concrete dust. I mean, you can, when you look at it carefully, the whole thing just goes up in smoke. You know, it, and where are the pancakes? Where are the floors? If this thing allegedly came down on top of each other and pancaked, you'd expect to see a pile of floors below there. There wasn't any of that. The thing was exploded outwards. And there's a lot more details to go into. We had squibs. We saw what are characteristics of controlled demolition, what are Kevin Ryan calls high-velocity explosions from a point-like source. And these are 40 floors below the line of, you know, the demolition line. 40 floors below that line, we see explosions outward. And there's been done some studies on that side as well. That stuff is moving somewhere in the order of 100 to 200 feet per second. It's a massive explosion going out about 100 feet or even more from a point-like source. People have tried to suggest that it was air pockets or something, but that's total bullshit because these floors were mostly empty halls. And if you had some kind of air pocket, it wouldn't be focused like a needle from all over the building. We saw these squibs, which are very consistent with controlled demolition. Anyways, I've kind of keep ranting. I'd like to play this clip.
I'm interested in everything.
Okay. Okay.
So I'm not I'm letting everything
okay,
go.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to stop it. I want to hear this.
Okay. So let me play the clip. I did the interview with Kevin Ryan. Can you bring up the?
It's up. It's up. You're listening to Kill Radio. This is Chris Burnett and Bennett.
Was not good science, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But I do want to quote quickly Dr. Jones's recent paper, Applying the Scientific Method. And he's in reference to the South Tower, he states, the South Tower, the collapse time of the South Tower was stated to be 10 seconds in the commission report. The free fall time of a brick dropped from the roof of the tower, which is 1,368 feet high, would be 9.2 seconds. The NIST final report avoids all issues that occur after the tower is poised for collapse, including the remarkably short collapse time. By ignoring all observations that occur after the towers are poised to collapse, NIST inherently ignores molten metal evidence, collapse features which are not well described by the hypothesized failure mode, and most of the forensic evidence contained in the rubble, dust, and aerosols which were collected in the days and months after the collapses. Clearly, NIST is ignoring a lot of data, and that is not good science. Let's talk about that for a second. What is this poised to collapse theory, or up to that point?
NIST calls it their collapse initiation sequence. And so, as you said, NIST took many years to give us a story about World Trade Center towers that was not complete. They don't describe the dynamics of the collapse of the buildings at all. And I think you've already said they have not at all given us an explanation for World Trade Center 7, the third building. So what evidence have they ignored? They've ignored the molten metal. As you said, there was molten metal in the rubble of all three buildings and also pouring from the South Tower before it collapsed. They've ignored the sulfidation and the intergranular melting of the steel, as we talked about. They ignored the fact that the antenna in the North Tower was shown to drop first, which indicates that the core of the building failed first, which is not consistent with their story. They ignored the high-velocity bursts of debris being ejected from what appear to be point-like sources. Some people call these demolition squibs, but that does presume a cause. So we should be able to just say they were high-velocity bursts of debris being ejected from point-like sources, and NIST doesn't address these things. They didn't address the near-free-fall speed, as you said, which really violates the law of the conservation of momentum. Each floor should have resisted the collapse of those buildings at least a fraction of a second. And unfortunately, that's not possible with nearly free fall speeds of 10 seconds. They also ignored eyewitness testimonies. There were over 100 testimonies of people taken right after the events of 9/11 that suggested that explosives and flashes of light were present. And there were also other witnesses who indicated there was foreknowledge of collapse of these buildings. All this was ignored by NIST, but what really drew my attention was that NIST had performed tests, physical tests themselves. They had performed tests to try and predict the steel temperatures found or seen by the samples they saved. You may know that they, at the World Trade Center, the steel was largely disposed of before it could be inspected, but 230 samples were saved, and some of those were tested in such a way we could determine the temperatures that they saw. And NIST found that the temperatures were very low, only about 250 degrees Celsius. Only 2% of those samples saw temperatures above 250 degrees Celsius. And that really is very low related to any temperature which could soften or even significantly weaken steel. There was also the UL floor model tests. And in those tests, while I worked there, models of floor assemblies were placed in furnaces for 2 hours at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And the floors were examined to evaluate the pancake theory, which was one of the primary theories of collapse. Well, the result was that the floor assemblies only sagged about 3 inches, where in fact not only was that result ignored, but in NIST's computer model, they expanded that to 42 inches, which is a very deceptive thing, and again, very unscientific. A third kind of physical test they did was one to prove that the fireproofing had been dislodged. A great deal of NIST's story depends on the wide dislodgement of fireproofing from all the columns and all the floor decks within the buildings. But NIST was not able to prove that. The only test they did for that was a very humble test, actually, where they shot a total of 15 rounds from a shotgun at a few unrepresentative samples. And they actually disproved their own theory by doing so because they found that the energy required, even for a shotgun, to blow the fireproofing off was just not present from the impact of the plane. So the problem that we had is we had all these results reported in the sub-reports of NIST, and then we go to their final summary report and find that they either ignored or directly contradicted those results. So that's very unscientific.
And, you know, there's 2 points there I want to focus on. One is the computer models that are crucial in this in their conclusion, in that the metal bent 42 inches when in fact the study, the actual empirical data, was 3 inches or 2 inches or something like that.
Absolutely, 3 inches after 2 hours. And interestingly,
and they're not releasing these computer models as far as I know, correct?
That's right. Not only are they not releasing their computer models, they're not releasing the thousands of photographs and video segments that they collected from the public during their investigation. So they seem to be hiding something. Not only that, they clearly, from their archive presentations, never examined the demolition hypothesis. And in addition, the NIST report was the last in several false stories given to support the fire-induced collapse hypothesis. So all of this adds up to really a bad scenario for us. We have these scientists who appear to be lying to us.
And I want to get to that actually in a second. And then the next point I want to make and to reemphasize what you were saying and for our listeners as well. Page 13 of Dr. Jones's paper, Applying the Scientific Method, which is on journalof911studies.com, page 13, it has this amazing visualization, which I found to be very, very helpful. It shows the top 14 block of
in the top 14 stories of, I believe, the North Tower. And it shows it without anything below it. And then it shows another image right next to it with the entire building below it. And what we are led to believe is that the portion of the 14 stories with nothing below it fell in roughly 9.6 seconds or whatever it was. And then if you look at it next with the entire building below it, you're still led to believe that there would be no resistance of this building below. And visually, I think it's one of the most compelling sort of tests that you can do for yourself just to think about what they're actually saying.
Absolutely. Chris, I would say that the only way that could be true is that the material below that falling mass had been removed by some means, right? And the only way that we can think of at this point is by explosives and by the use of incendiary reactions like the thermite reaction.
All right, that was...
And we're back.
That was Kevin Ryan. He was he's a co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies and former laboratory manager. He's a chemist who worked at UL, the people who certified the steel.
Was he actually on site at Ground Zero?
No.
Okay.
No, he wasn't. What else? I mean, there's a lot of other really strange issues, of course, surrounding 9/11. But one point I want to make, just real quick, is the... there's a difference between circumstantial evidence, and empirical data. And there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. We talked about this in our emails, Bennett. Like a lot of people who are have their personal testimony and their experiences, and I think that helps out round out the picture of what I think happened on 9/11. But then we have the scientists doing real studies and creating models and looking at evidence. And that stuff is the reason I'm only focusing on the science is because I think it's the strongest. I think once we get into sort of the personal characteristics of individuals or whatever, we enter into a realm of potentially into speculation. And I think Loose Change's first movie, people may have seen it. I don't think it was very good. I don't recommend it because it does enter into
either.
A lot of speculation. You're like, I don't care. Yeah, some plane landed in Ohio, and therefore, there you go. That's the proof that these planes weren't being flown or whatever.
I'll give Dylan Avery the credit that he tries to update, and they're about to post the third version or something like that. Now, I'll give them credit for that.
Yeah, I mean, and I haven't seen it, so I can't really comment on the new version. But there's a lot of horrible ideas surrounding 9/11. There's a lot of people who are saying some wacky shit.
Well, just for the record, let's spend a moment with the wacky, just for a moment.
Okay.
Because I had just started doing the news for Kill Radio when September 11th happened. So within 4 or 5 days of September 11th, the wacky things were starting to come out. We were getting reports of drone, robot-controlled airplanes were the ones. Laser beams from space. The first Loose Change tries to say that the planes themselves were shooting missiles into the building just before they hit.
Yeah, there's like light, apparently a flash or something. It's like, yeah, that's interesting, but so what? You can't prove anything. Mm-hmm. It's like there's so much. And the Pentagon is still the issue of the plane or not plane. I think there's so little evidence about what's happened at the Pentagon. I mean, a lot of people would disagree with me who study a lot of the 9/11 stuff, but I just think that it's a waste of time to argue about the Pentagon because it's a weak argument. There's people who say, well, there could have been a plane that hit, and there's a lot of speculation around that, and I just don't find it compelling.
Okay.
I think that... The real question, and Dr. Frank Legge, who I did interview yesterday, he was saying the real question about the Pentagon is why did it hit the building in the first place? I mean, the most fortified military building in the United States and probably the world. No plane should have ever hit that. They have anti-aircraft devices all over the place. Why did it hit? That's a more interesting question to me. And also, there's video that we know of that they've said officially that they've confiscated video from around buildings, from gas stations and hotels. Why aren't they releasing these videos? I mean, I think that is compelling in the sense of, well, if a plane hit the building, let's see the videos that you confiscated.
Well, for the record, there was actual surveillance video at the Pentagon, right. And that has been made available.
Right, but you
but
can't
it was
see
only
much.
Shooting one frame per second.
Yeah,
and so you do not see a plane. You you see an explosion.
You see something, and you just can't. And you know, if there was a plane, they should let's see the
video.
Well,
there was a fuselage, and there and hundreds of people saw a plane.
Yeah, I believe that some kind of plane hit the Pentagon. I don't know what it was. I stay away from that because I don't think it's compelling. It's hard to argue,
and it's much harder to argue what happened with Flight 93 as well.
Yeah, yeah, and. And I just
because there ain't no documentation there except one photograph that one woman took shortly after whatever crash there was, and it shows smoke going up in the air over a hill.
Yeah, that's all you see. And you know, even if and it's I think it's likely that they shot it down, and that's probably why there's a big brown hole in the middle of the ground. You know, it's like okay, so it's almost again, Flight 93 is like yeah, you don't see any sort of typical crash site, but. Okay, so what? So the government comes out and said, yeah, sorry, we shut it down. Then, you know, it's easy for them to deal with that problem. So, again, I tend to stay away from...
But there, the other evidence we have are the phone calls and the things that were told about what happened.
Right. There is a physicist who actually went up in a plane and did his own experimentation with cell phones, which was very interesting. There's a video of him talking about it. And he wasn't able to make any calls above 5,000 feet. And he goes into the science of how cell phones work because they actually send out a horizontal signal. They don't send a vertical signal.
Well, there was something like 27 calls made from Flight 93. Only three were made on cell phones. The others were made on the air phones.
Yeah,
and those are designed to go above.
Right. And I, you know, there's and apparently the one of the planes, I think it was 93. Didn't have phones installed in the seats on that model or something at that time.
That's the accusation, but yeah. We have the call.
Yeah, and again, it's like, you know, it's I don't know what's going on there. But I think there's basically two sort of theories going on around LIHOP and MIHOP. Uh-huh. Basically, you know what that is? Let it happen on purpose or made it happen on purpose.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sort of the opinion and open to the idea that maybe there was some kind of hijacking. Maybe there was some kind of people who are participating in these exercises. And we do know that this is been publicly or officially documented that there were a number of military exercises taking place
on that day.
Simulated actual planes hitting buildings, which is again adds to the whole picture of like what the fuck was that about, right?
Uh-huh. Lots of confusion.
Yeah, like why the hell would they be conducting exercises coincidentally on the same day where planes are hijacked and run into buildings? I mean, that's like what the fuck, you know? Something's going on there. That's really I don't know, but again, this is the circumstantial stuff, right? This is where we
exactly.
Start to speculate, and we are tempted to draw really bad conclusions or wrong conclusions. So I'm open to the idea that maybe something did happen where people were involved. Maybe it was a combination of the two. Maybe, and I believe that there were explosives in Building 7 in the Trade Centers, and perhaps that was made set up in order to make sure that those buildings came down. That
Or perhaps it was just coincidentally happening the same day.
You know, I don't know. But I think the scientific evidence and a lot of the scientists are now coming out challenging the official story. I don't know if you've seen patriotsquestion911.com. Have you seen that site?
I don't know. I haven't.
I strongly recommend to your listeners and yourself to check out patriotsquestion911.com.
Okay.
And what it is lists and photographs of hundreds of professors, scientists, architects and engineers, of ex-military and government officials who've publicly come out and said that they do not believe the official account of 9/11. And they have all their testimony, their documentation, and their credentials on that site. Literally hundreds. And just in the last 2 weeks, I mentioned this yesterday on my program and when I interviewed Dr. Leggy. In the last 2 weeks, two very prominent scientists have come out and said that the official account is bogus and a fraud. And one of them is this woman, Dr. Margulis, who is a distinguished professor. She's a distinguished professor at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, and ran the geosciences department. She was given a by Bill Clinton in 1999. She was given the sort of honorary degree, or not degree, medal, like a national, a science medal. It's a very
prominent
medal.
I think I remember
medal.
That, actually.
This just happened 2 weeks ago. Uh-huh. She came out and said that she believes that the official account is a fraud. And that's a big deal. And there's another scientist who worked for the OTA, the Office of Technology Assessment. It's a congressional body. He's testified in front of Congress 50 times. His name is Dr. Hirshhorn. And he's a metallurgical professor. He's taught at Madison, University of Madison for 13 years, and then he went on to do a lot of heading up departments for the Governors Association on Environment and Science. He's a big guy. You know, he's been around. He's a basically a government scientist. And he came out last week and said, I believe that the official account is a fraud. So we're getting a lot more credentialed people coming out.
Well, I have to say that that's really good, because in the research that was done to at least up until about 6 months ago onto the group called Scholars for 9/11 Truth, most of the people's background were not in the sciences at all. They were English professors. The majority were philosophy professors.
Right. There's a point to make. There's a distinguishing thing there. There's three sites. There's two sites, right? Remember, Jim Fetzer and Dr. Jones split. And I personally have a – I don't really – I think Jim Fetcher's style is a little problematic. But he ran Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and I think that might be the site you're talking about. Uh-huh. Dr. Jones and Kevin Ryan started a new site called Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, which is a front site sort of as a group of scientists coming together. So that does include a lot of people, like professors who aren't scientists, but and a lot of scientists as well. But then there's the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which is a very specific site dedicated to a peer-reviewed scientific journal.
Okay.
So there's journalofnineelevenstudies.com, which is the site I usually refer to people. And I strongly encourage you to check out Patriots – I hate that name, by the way. PatriotsQuestion911.com. It's like – but, you know, it's a good site. And there's a lot of very credentialed people there. But they break it down into the professors from every background, including, you know, psychology and English or whatever, but then they have all the engineers. And there's another great site that launched this year called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
I've spent some time on that site. I've listened to Richard Gage talk. Yeah.
AE911truth.org. But we're starting to see literally hundreds of architects and engineers. These are the people who build buildings. They know how these things are put together. They're coming out and challenging the official story, calling for reinvestigation.
Well, I have to ask, did you read Brent Blanchard's analysis?
I didn't get a chance to, but I promise I will.
Okay. I mean, I don't want to be an authority-oriented person, but most of the points he makes seem to be pretty clear, and I don't know. For instance, just as an example, he puts it better than I do. We were talking about the squibs, okay? The assertion, explosive charges, i.e. plumes, squids, etc., can clearly be seen shooting from several floors just prior to the collapse. He says, no, air and debris can be seen pushing violently outward, which is a natural and predictable effect of rapid structural collapse. Human-inhabited buildings are typically comprised of about 70% air and 30% structural elements and contents. During any rapid collapse, that air must be displaced in some manner. Therefore, when gravity makes a structure fall downward, the air within the structure is propelled horizontally through windows, door frames, and any other path of least resistance. In the case of World Trade Center 1 and 2, it has been scientifically documented that the failures of interior floor trusses were occurring slightly ahead of exterior columns, which is why the columns fell outward and contributed to a mushrooming effect. Another side effect of this unequal progression was that air and various lightweight office contents was forced out of windows well below the visible collapse mechanism. The amount of debris seen jettisoning from any given floor or window was likely dependent on the condition of the windows, obstructions, or furniture blocking the windows, and the amount and weight of the debris. The existence of vacant and non-occupied mechanical floors also likely affected the level or absence of expulsion in certain areas. Again, it is important to note that neither building structurally failed at any location where plumes were visible, nor did they fail at any point in advance of the single gravitational collapse sequence, which tells us that the plume phenomenon witnessed was a predictable effect that gravity dictates had to occur.
Okay, there's a lot of stuff there. And he says it's been scientifically proven that the collapse mechanism was as he described, and that's simply not true. As we heard with Kevin Ryan's interview, they have not scientifically proven that the truss failures would occur. Their own studies have shown that the failure would not have happened. Their computer models have been altered. They will not release it. There is a lot that, so first of all,
if I may, the only difference that I can say here is that he was there. He was there on September 11th itself. He is a controlled demolition expert who has done this thousands of times all over the world. He was not being paid. This was Protech did this on their own. It was their own analysis. He examined all the photos. He talked to Dr. Jones for hours and exchanged emails with him for 6 months. He listened to all the people, and these are his reports. I got to give him some credit.
Well, I remember his name because it's been brought up in a number of the papers. He's been challenged by many scientists, including Gordon Ross. He's a mechanical engineer who's done the calculations on this, and he's just as qualified, probably more qualified, because he's actually a mechanical engineer and he does the math and he goes through it. He's wrong. There's never been a building to collapse like this. For him to say that this is typical or predictable is simply wrong because we have no previous examples. The point, like the debris of the squibs, for him to claim that that's a natural occurrence from air, that actual very issue was challenged on journalof911studies.com by Kevin Ryan in his paper, Debris Moving Out from Point-Like Sources. And he goes through explaining how, A, it's impossible for that to happen because and the way that the building was built, there is no way that 40 floors below the demolition front would be able to press air 40 floors down and create a point-like source of ejection. And that point-like source was probably, from what we can tell, roughly in the range of a foot or two. And it was very high projectile shooting outward at about 200 feet per second.
Oh, I've watched the squibs many times in the falls. Yeah.
Yeah. And he goes through the fact that you look at the actual structure of the building, you can see pictures of it. It's a very open field almost. Each floor was basically an open field with the 47 core columns in the center, which are hermetically sealed, by the way, which means that they're hermetically sealed for a purpose, and that is to prevent, if there ever was a fire, to prevent them from going from floor to floor through the center columns, which means in the elevators themselves were sealed as well. So you couldn't even get air to move down the center column 40 floors because the way that they built the building. And this is actually covered in a number of the papers as well. So the idea that 40 floors below the demolition front, air managed to make its way down through all these floors, and then in an entire open floor managed to find its way through a very narrow 2-foot range and then shoot out horizontally at 100 or 200 feet per second it's just absurd. And that actual very issue is dealt with in Kevin Ryan's paper. And a number of other I don't know who, if Dr. Bezant works, I don't know if he's a doctor or not, or what his credentials are, but you have to also realize a really important point was made by the demolition expert in the Swiss folks, these structural engineers who came out and said Building 7 was definitely controlled demolition. Jawenko, I think his name is, he's the Dutch demolition expert. He said absolutely to this day he still believes that the buildings were demolished, and he says it's typical demolition characteristics. Cutting it goes out from the bottom, and then he had the center columns coming in, et cetera. But he makes a really important point. It's like, look, if you are a company in the United States who does demolitions, and there's only a handful of them, I think there's like six or even less, if you come out and oppose a government story, the likelihood of you getting work in this country is pretty nil. You're not going to go out on a limb and risk your livelihood by challenging the official story, especially since a lot of demolitions – you're going to get contracts from government, city officials, et cetera. It makes sense that, a lot of demolition experts apparently have pretty much been silent on the issue. I think David Ray Griffin has made this point as well. So I don't know who this guy is. I'd like to read it. But I know that his analysis has been challenged on Journal of 9/11 Studies.com.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we should follow up on it and debate it. I'll try and find some more work on looking
like
at this
guy. I'd like to see some writing by others because he is a controlled demolition expert. I mean, that's –
Why was he there?
He was actually working in New York on the day it happened.
Was he with FEMA?
No. He wasn't working for the government. All of that is actually dealt with in the entire essay. So,
okay. I will definitely follow up on it.
Yeah. What it seems to me that's happening is that we're talking about a lot of anomalies, and we agree that not every question can be answered, right?
Well, no, yeah, of course not. But we do have we haven't talked about the molten metal, which is a huge issue. You do not get molten metal without high temperatures, and you don't get high temperatures without some kind of highly exothermic reaction. And that's a big deal.
The problem with the molten metal is who saw it.
There's photographic evidence of molten metal.
Do we know that it's steel?
Do we know
that it's not aluminum?
Yes, and there was tests done.
Based on the color?
Yes. Color is very...
That's absolutely significant.
Yeah, color is very significant when you're dealing with metals. And there's a whole chart listing colors associated with temperatures. And it's actually one of Dr. Jones' his area of expertise.
But that brings up the one photograph that I sent to you that actually even references Blanchard. Right? This one.
Yeah, that one is the reason that... And that's a good photograph because what we see there is the end product of the thermate reaction.
This is not molten metal.
No, it's the end
No, it's not molten metal at all. That's the problem.
No, it was molten metal. That's the point.
No.
Yes.
It's this.
Yeah,
it's the floors compressed together.
No, no, that's not true. And this is where we were talking about. The science is very important here. You cannot get that metal to take that shape without being molten at one point.
It's not all metal.
Well, it's certainly going to contain other elements, but it's cooled
furniture.
Yeah, that metal is not molten
pipes,
right now.
Cords, even papers right. with legible type.
Right, but the end product of the thermate reaction is rust, and that's what we see on there, and it's very consistent with thermate, and that is very consistent with molten metal. But putting that aside, we do have photographic evidence for molten metal. We also have firefighters who are in videos, which you can see. More than one person has said, and we have. I'll give you three pieces of evidence for molten metal. One is we have photographic evidence of the cleanup process, where we actually see the crane pulling out very clearly metal that has a particular color, which is associated with a particular temperature. You can look at charts and go, that thing is way above the melting point of aluminum or any other substance. You can't get those temperatures without a highly exothermic reaction. So we have one. That's one. We have firefighter testimony of saying, and below us, it was like being in a furnace. There was metal molting, like moving through a foundry. We have that as direct evidence from the firefighters. And then we have satellite photographs that show a temperature gradient of 727 degrees Celsius. And that's on the surface, and it's going to be a lot hotter underneath. But 727 degrees Celsius is very significant because that's way above the melting point of aluminum. It's around 600 degrees Celsius. Mm-hmm. In order to even have a satellite, we have satellite data that shows in each below building 1, 2, and 7, we see evidence from the temperature gradient from these satellite photos, and they're all around 727 degrees Celsius, and this is on the surface. This is not below, which is going to be a lot hotter. So we have that evidence. And in order to get molten metal, you cannot get molten metal unless you bring the temperatures up to the melting point of steel, which is about 1500 degrees Celsius. What is and again, you combine that with the evidence for the thermate reaction, the X-ray energy dispersive spectroscopy, and we look at the elemental analysis. We see the characteristics of thermate. Again, that's consistent with molten metal. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that we can look at and say, and then you start to put the whole picture together. We have molten metal actually falling out of the South Tower, which we see visually in videos. And there's been, you know, one of the parts of Dr. Jones's paper, he spends a lot of time on this molten metal. One of his a grad student, a physicist, said, well, that color can come from aluminum mixed with other organics, right? And this young physics student said no, so he went to Dr. Jones and said, oh, let's do the experiment. They melted aluminum, and they got it flowing, and then he tried to add every possible thing you could add in from an office, like furniture, computers, anything that would melt, and mix it in there, carpet, anything. And at the end of the day, they could never get that aluminum to have that color. So it's and the way it flows is very characteristic and of a thermate reaction or a thermite reaction. So there's a lot of very good evidence. And then, again, some of the models that were done by Gordon Ross on the collapse issues, to me, the evidence, again, you know, and I've said this, I sound like a broken record, it's convincing to me that these buildings were brought down by explosives. Which, again, we haven't even talked about. Could Al-Qaeda get into the buildings to plant explosives? Who could plant explosives? Marvin Bush was on the company called Securicom. He was on the board of the company that was in charge of security for the World Trade Centers. And his cousin, Walker the Third, or whatever his name is, was head of security, Securicom. And Bush's brother's on the board, which is very strange. The only buildings damaged that day were buildings owned by Larry Silverstein, which he got all the money, you know, from the collapses.
He's still trying to collect, $1.5 billion or something like that.
And you've got to ask yourself another telling question is, look at all the buildings surrounding 1 and 2. There's buildings 3, 4, and 5, right? These were located right below the Twin Towers. They were severely damaged from the falling debris.
Mm-hmm.
But their structure is intact. There's for steel frame structures from building 3, 4, and 5 located right next to 1 and 2, all intact. They didn't collapse. Yet, a football field away, building 7, which barely got touched on the corner, not compared to 3, 4, and 5, which were totally damaged, but their internal structures
actually,
were standing.
Actually, I think it's building 5. No, that's the other corner. I forget which building it is, but it's actually in the way of the debris field in front of building 7.
And you look at the map, building 7's pretty far away, and it barely got damaged from the corner. Yet, buildings 3, 4, and 5, their structural integrity was there. It didn't fall. Yet, we're led to believe that building 7, at 5:20 p.m., just goes bam in 6.5 seconds. It's the only way to do that is to cut the inner core columns and break them for it to fall down evenly.
Well, can I throw a piece of speculation out?
Yeah.
Silverstein was there when the buildings went up. He owned the buildings, or however you put that. Actually, it was Griffin who made this comment that perhaps when they built 7, which was actually built in the late 80s, it was not built at the same time as the other two towers, right?
Yeah.
Perhaps they wired it for demolition when they built it. Now,
who knows?
Perhaps. And so, speculation, who knows? Maybe whatever happened when the building was damaged in the fall of the tower, maybe that set off the demolition that was there. The only reason that doesn't make a lot of sense to me is because I would think they would admit that.
Yeah. Well, then it opens up a lot of questions like, oh, really? You planted explosives in the building? Why did you do that?
Because they knew eventually the building would come down, and it's a very expensive process to gut and prepare to demolish a building. That's why they would do it.
Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Make a lot of sense to me either. That's why it's just speculation.
Yeah. I mean, who in their right mind – have that ever happened in history? I don't know. Not that I know of. But, you know, it's – Why on earth would they do that? But the reason that let me ask you.
But I would think that, especially regarding conspiracies, they would admit that the building was wired for demolition if it were true.
Right. Well, okay. But to answer your question about the, even if it was had explosives pre-planted, we have very strong evidence for the foreknowledge of the fall of Building 7.
Again, it was announced at 3 o'clock on September 11th, 2 hours and 20 minutes before
firefighters were saying, get away from the building, it's going to come down.
Yeah.
the BBC reported 20 minutes in advance that Building 7 fell, when in fact the reporter's sitting there talking about it and the building standing behind her.
In the background.
You're like, oh, somebody told you that Building 7 is going to come down. And you have to ask yourself.
Well, they knew it was going to come down.
Right. Well, yeah, but that is a huge piece of evidence. Why would it come down at all? Why would it come down? There's no reason to believe for 100 years buildings built by steel don't fall from fire. Why would they know that this was going to come down other than that it was planted with explosives? That's the only way they would know. They wouldn't go, my God, I think Building 7 is going to come down because it has a small fire on the south part of the building. The only way they would know that it was going to come down is that it had explosives in the building, which is very consistent with the controlled demolition hypothesis.
And we admit that there has been no answer given. I totally admit that no specific answer has been given. What about the seismic evidence? Just for the report there, up at Columbia University, there were seismographs reporting on that day. The seismographic evidence shows that the major impacts, the two planes hitting the building, both registered. The three buildings collapsing, all three registered. Any explosion that would be strong enough to blow away steel would definitely cause ground vibrations that would register. There are no large explosions before the buildings collapse.
Well, there are two. I don't think that evidence is.
I think it's pretty substantial myself.
I don't. What people have argued is that the two spikes are actually a result of the pre-basement explosions in the World Trade Center towers, which is actually more consistent showing up on their radar or on their seismographs than the plane hitting the building, because the plane hit up at 100 feet, whereas that wouldn't have nearly the kind of registered impact as explosions connected to bedrock. And
again, if it blows out steel beams from the bedrock, it would definitely register ground vibrations.
Right. Well, that's exactly my point. That's actually very good evidence for the pre-basement explosions, which we do have firsthand testimony from a number of people that there were pre-basement explosions. And this is William Rodriguez's story.
We definitely know that when the plane hit the South Tower, I believe it was, that a fireball went straight down an elevator shaft and exploded in the basement.
No, see, that we don't know because that's...
Yeah, well, that's the reports. I mean, that's...
That's maybe the official story, but there's no evidence for that. In fact...
The evidence has been considered. I mean, to say there's no evidence for it...
No evidence for a fireball. That's the point. The hermetically sealed features of the elevator shafts would prevent anything coming down the building like that. That's where you look at the structural design of building 1 and 2, and it's impossible for a fireball to make its way down to the basement. And that's where, if you combine that with there's over 118 firefighters who've personal testimony about the presence of explosives in the building. David Ray Griffin has documented this very well.
That's where I got the same number, 118.
Right, 118 firefighters who all documented and said that there were explosives pre-planted in the building.
But no, they reported hearing explosive sounds.
Well, they believe, many of them believe that they were planted. But you have an explosion in the basement. This is below the first level. There was an explosion on the first level, and a lot of testimony of people coming in going, what the fuck is the basement blown up for? It doesn't make any sense. The firefighters are running up the building. They're looking around going, why is this basement blown up? Or the first floor blown up? But we have testimony and physical evidence from people getting broken bones, broken faces, from walls exploding into their face in the basements. And this is, again, consistent with a controlled demolition because you want to take out the basement for this building to fall into. And we have William Rodriguez's story, which is basically, I was in the basement. I felt an explosion come below me and lift me up. And this was before the first plane hit the building. And it seemed what it appears – according to his story, and he's not the only one who said this, by the way, is that they tried to time the basement explosions with the plane hitting the tower and didn't exactly time it right. But then there was one guy on the video in 9/11 Mysteries. I believe he was a firefighter or a construction worker or something. He was in, he ran from one basement to the other because they from tower 1 to 2 or 2 to 1. I can't remember. He's in the basement. Hears the explosions. And he's like, holy shit! He's running into people whose faces are blown off in the basement. Goes to the other basement and he runs into other people and he felt another explosion. There's hundreds of eyewitness testimony about explosions in the building, and I think it's compelling. William Rodriguez's story is compelling, that there was pre-planted explosives.
Well, all right. then let's move to the larger issues. How was it done?
I don't know. I don't know how it was done, but you know, there's a lot of speculation on how you would plant explosives in the trade centers. There's a lot of testimony by people who were in the building where security was shut down for a number of days prior to 9/11. Television monitors, screens.
Well, I used to work in the World Trade Center back in the late 70s, and I worked in Building 5 in the mid 80s for 2 or 3 years as well. I spent a lot of time around the World Trade Center. It was a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week building. There were always people around. So whatever security was shut down, there were always people there. I mean, all the time. So,
well, the security was taken over in 98, 99 by Securicom. There's a in the movie 9/11 Mysteries, there is a database administrator featured, interviewed, talking about what happened in the weeks prior to 9/11. There was a lot of strange construction work going on because it was above his floor. He was and being a database administrator, he's worried about servers and uptime. Like, to bring down power in a building is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I was in the World Trade Center once when we had a power blackout in New York City, and I watched thousands of people because the subways weren't working, walking home. But the generators kicked right in, and we had electricity.
Right. Well, and his testimony is, you know, it was a very strange weekend prior to 9/11. He actually took they actually shut down the power in the building, and because, you know, he's like, shit, I have to run these servers, he had to go in like on like Monday or late Sunday night or something and work all day to bring the servers back up. But they had a major power shutdown, and they were warned about it at the very last minute, so the entire power went out in the building that weekend. And there's a lot of other strange phenomenon going on with construction, which he describes in 9/11 Mysteries. Mm-hmm. You can watch the whole movie, by the way, on Google. Just search 9/11
Mysteries. It's there, and I've watched it. Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, there's, again, now we're getting into the area of sort of a lot of very interesting circumstantial evidence, or I shouldn't say circumstantial, but it is kind of circumstantial. But we have eyewitness testimonies. We have testimonies from a number of people. And I think this stuff helps to round out the bigger picture when we're moving away from the scientific analysis.
Fair enough.
You know, I don't think it's 100%. Like, you can, testimony is always helpful. But it's not going to be as strong as hard scientific data. But I think it tells a really interesting story. And you know, we have 118 firefighters talking about explosions. We have William Rodriguez, who worked in the building for 30 years. He, you know, you work in a place, you kind of know it. I would trust him to – he's not lying when he says the explosion blew him upwards in the basements, which means it was below him. You know, where did that come from? How did that happen? Do we have other testimony of pre-impact explosions in the basements from other people? There's a lot of eyewitness testimony from firefighters describing explosions. It all paints a picture, and it becomes very consistent. And I think 9/11 was an inside job. I think somebody in a position of power had the ability to get in there and pull this off because it was their new 9/11. It justified all the wars and invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, a Patriot Act. Everything's been used since 9/11 to justify.
Unquestionably. Yeah. I don't even think it was just the Bush administration. As Chomsky says, everybody all over the world was glad this happened because they could use it for their own justifications.
Absolutely.
All the time. I have a really hard time, though, thinking that the Bush administration, who have bungled pretty much every single thing they've done, they bungled the Iraq War, they bungled Katrina, they bungled every single thing that they do. He couldn't even get his Social Security initiative passed. He goes around the country, you know, talking to millions of people, and yet to say that, you know, that he's an evil genius and
he's a bungling
idiot.
No, I never said that. We don't know who did this. I've never said that Bush is, I believe Bush is so incompetent. He might have known about it.
Well, we have film of when he got the news.
Right. Well,
and he sits there and doesn't even look presidential.
Okay, but the whole idea of bungling, I have a problem with. Because I think that the neocons know exactly what they're doing. I think it's a mistake to believe that Iraq, from their point of view, is a failure. I think from the media's point of view and our sort of the lies around, you know, spreading democracy to the Middle East is total nonsense. In fact, what the bigger picture of hegemony and control of the oil in the Middle East and control of the region is important to them. Military bases are important to them. In fact, you could argue that a civil war is actually a very good thing because chaos allows them to maintain control in that region, at least to a certain extent, and allows them to stay in that region because they can justify it by saying it's too chaotic to leave. There's a lot of reasons to believe that, in fact, you know, Iraq is a success from the point of view of the neocons. As far as, you know, Bush having anything to do with this, I don't think so. Cheney, possibly, maybe have insight. But there's a lot of speculation about who and what. It could have been a private company, which has a lot more internal control over the people who would have done this and planted explosives. It could have been, you know, extra paramilitary or something associated with people in the military but done by a private company. You know, in that sense, it doesn't leave any bureaucracy, any paper trails, anything like that. There's a lot of speculation as to who it could have been, but, you know, I don't know, and I don't think any of us know. But what we do know is that the official account, NIST's own report, is just a lie. It's incomplete. It's bad science. There's something going on. I think there's a lot of things that are being covered up. And I think that we need to have a new investigation. And I think that the only thing we can say right now is we need a new investigation that's impartial, and we need to get to the bottom of a lot of these answers. And you got to ask yourself, why the fuck did they pull the steel away and ship it to China? I mean, it's absurd. That was a crime scene. You know, there's so many things that are going on that you're like, it doesn't make sense from the way that they tell the story, but it does make sense from the point of view of covering up a crime.
I'm sorry, I'm looking for something specific about the I don't know. You'll just disagree with it. Now, the statement is that things were removed and shipped to China, and not according to the people who were actually there. That wasn't true.
Some of
it may have been, but not everything.
I think the majority of it was shipped. The NIST's own report says they only retained 200 samples.
Because of their own reasoning, yeah.
Well, okay. But, you know, a typical... there's so much that happened that was outside of protocol that is very strange.
The large steel support members extracted from Ground Zero were handled differently than other debris, mostly because of their size and quantity. Once the steel was extracted, it was piled in staging areas just outside the work zones. These piles were then loaded onto trucks, then transported a few blocks north to a secondary staging area. Cranes transferred the steel from the trucks onto barges, which were shipped to Freshkills Landfill in Staten Island, etc.
And then the steel was shipped off site to China.
Our research team can personally verify the lower Manhattan chain of possession as we witnessed and documented this chain.
This is Bazant or whatever? Is this Bazant?
This is Protec. This is Blanchard.
What's his name?
Brent Blanchard.
Blanchard.
Yeah.
How do you he works for NIST, doesn't he?
He works for Protec, which is a... They might claim that he works for NIST, but he's
what's his name? Brent? What's can you go up?
Brent Blanchard.
Blanchard. All right. I'm going to look that up.
Okay.
there is a lot of evidence that, well, not even evidence, it's fact that the people who normally deal with plane side investigations, I think it's the FAA, they gave up their search for the planes. By the way, where was the plane debris? What happened to the plane debris? Not a word was ever said about that. You should have been able to find a titanium engine, you know, in both World Trade Center 1 and 2.
That I don't know. Certainly makes sense to me that the planes were utterly destroyed.
Well, I'm sure they were too. You should be able to find some of that metal, and well, certainly the engines.
They've certainly found some of it.
Well, I haven't heard any evidence that they actually found any of the wreckage from the plane. They never did if you read the the fire safety people, I'm blanking out on their names, but the magazine that does the forensic investigations for firefighters, it's a community of people who deal with all the sort of forensic investigations of fire. They called the whole 9/11 inquiry and commission report and FEMA a total sham. And they were saying they're hiding something. These are the firefighters, the people who are responsible for forensic investigations, the people who would do the analysis on the steel to see if there was anything wrong or out of the ordinary, or look for thermite. That was never done. So you have fire authorities going, they're hiding something. It's sort of endless, right? Everything that happened that day is so out of sight of protocol, and so bizarre that you're like, They're hiding something, and it's, you know, again, I'm getting into areas that I normally feel like I'm speculating when I'm talking about what could have happened or what did or did not happen.
Well, I understand.
Science.
I don't want to make you uncomfortable there. This weekend, I prepared and did a lengthy 9/11 timeline of events from 1977 up to 2001. Based on several different sources, and how do I put this? Essentially, I mean, you don't believe it's possible that 19 hijackers hijacked planes and crashed them into buildings?
No, I don't. I think it's an absurd conspiracy theory.
But can't you agree that if people were going to do something like that, the only way that they would be able to actually do it is if it were a very small group of people?
I find this particular issue,
because there's a long history going back well over a decade of Bin Laden and his associates planning to take out symbolic targets in the United States.
So we are told.
So we have documentation that goes back in time.
Well, okay, first of all, Bin Laden was created by the United States government.
Well,
was paid for by the CIA, all right, well, and funded
but
in
to do
Afghanistan
it, to do it
to
briefly,
the
yeah, they in
for
a, in,
10 years.
In an attack on the Soviet Union, they decided to inflame ethnic tensions in Afghanistan,
right,
so that the Muslims would attack the Soviets.
Osama
genocidally.
Osama is a U.S. asset, and he was for 15 years or something. So you can't forget about that history. And you know, do I believe that a guy in a cave, you know, living in the hills in Afghanistan, could pull off 19 hijackers breaking in, you know, getting onto planes with box cutters, successfully taking over and flying these airlines into planes? Which, if you read, there's actually another site which comes to mind, which is Pilots for 9/11 Truth. Pilots, 30-year veterans, saying there's no way in hell that these pilots could have pulled off these maneuvers. And these are 30-year veterans who've been flying these planes forever. To believe that 19 hijackers managed to take over these planes with box cutters and then fly them successfully into their targets is absurd. And, you know, this is, to me, it's absolutely
absurd.
I think it's absurd. Yeah. And I think that if you carefully listen to what pilots have to say about flying these things and
again,
go to their sites.
Again, you're not talking to people who were there. You're talking to people who are saying it's impossible. Whenever I hear the word impossible, I know
highly improbable.
Highly improbable.
Okay, I'll say highly improbable.
Really, I really find that questionable, because anything can happen.
Okay, you know? Occam's razor is this idea that the simplest explanation is
absolutely
the best one.
Yeah.
Dr. Frank Legge, who I interviewed yesterday, I don't know if you heard the show.
I did not, I'm sorry.
Okay. He's a PhD chemist from Australia, And he deals specifically in his recent paper on journalof911studies.com. I'm going to throw that out there again. Deals with this particular issue of Occam's razor, which a lot of people raise, saying, which is essentially the idea that this, if in a situation, oftentimes the simplest explanation is the best. He goes through it meticulously and says, okay, let's look at the hijacker scenario. It is not the simplest explanation. In fact, it's probably one of the most highly complicated ones to come together if that were to actually happen, because the hijackers would have had to find, luckily, get NORAD to stand down. There's a lot of issues around NORAD standing down.
NORAD started standing down when the Soviet Union stepped down. There were only 14 planes run by NORAD at the time of September 11th.
The entire air infrastructure, the response mechanism, and this is – you can listen. Response mechanism just stood down, and they didn't get any planes to respond. The idea that they could actually take over the planes, the idea that they actually fly the planes, the idea that some dude in a cave in Afghanistan is going to direct this operation. You have to realize also that there were plenty of warnings. They would have to get – there were warnings coming from within the FBI saying that there's these people, you know, we don't know what's going on. A lot of, you know, speculation as to who they were. They were being studied. But somebody had to prevent – the higher-ups in the FBI from pursuing these cases. So when
I can give you a long history of how the U.S.
Let me finish my point.
When they could have. Okay.
Let me finish my point. My point is that when you start to look at the official story, it becomes highly improbable, and it actually violates Occam's razor, which is that it's not a simple operation to get everything to happen the way it did. And listen to the testimony from air traffic controllers in Boston. They're saying they knew immediately there was something wrong because they managed – the other issue is that during these war games, somehow the instrumentation used by these air traffic controllers was set up in a way that would allow them to see the blips of the exercises that the military was doing. And just that technology alone is a highly complicated technology. Why are commercial air traffic controllers having to see blips from military exercises on their radar screens, which is documented? Why is that? There's so much going on. Listen to the pilots.
I have to admit, I know nothing about that. I do know that Logan Airport had. Had some of the most severe security violations of any airports in this country 10 years before September 11th. So that the fact that two of the planes came from there doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, and we've got four of the hijackers who are still alive, by the way.
That's not true.
Well, I mean, the BBC documented it.
That was one that I was here, or I was on Kill Radio when that first came out, and that was a mistake. I can send you the correction from the BBC. The 15 who were from Saudi Arabia have all been acknowledged by the Saudi government.
I haven't seen that. But again, we're getting into areas which I don't think is a strong case. I mean, we can talk back and forth on this, mm-hmm. and we have to go through very meticulously all the evidence and go through it. But again, the strongest evidence for me is the scientific evidence. We have thermite. We have all the scientists at journalof911studies.com doing their studies, challenging the NIST report. The NIST report was not science. It's bad science, bad predictions, black box computer models, which they refused to release to the public. We have evidence for controlled demolition. We have evidence for explosions. We have now 250 or so architects and engineers challenging the official story of the collapse of the buildings. We have prominent scientists coming out saying the report isn't accurate. Again, the strongest evidence, and that's the thing I always stick to, is look at the buildings, the WTC buildings, because that is where we are going to break this through.
Okay.
You know, all the other stuff about hijackers, you know, I personally believe it's impossible. I think their story is ridiculous. But we can go back and forth for hours saying, well, no, yes, no, yes. And it's speculation and, you know.
Well, I have to say that I was afraid that this would turn into some kind of fight, and I didn't want it to be a fight. I really wanted to listen, and I'm taking everything you say very seriously.
Well, I am too. I want to read the stuff that you have, and I want to, you know. I've spent a long time researching this because – The thing that stuck out for me was all the science. My background is in chemistry.
Yes.
When I was looking at the science and the evidence and the data presented by other scientists, it was compelling. And I strongly believe that 911 is an inside job, and that that you know, time will tell. And the more that we get people to come out and talk about it, the better. And again, go to patriotsquestion911.com.
Okay.
Look at the credentials of the people coming out. It's not a, you know, a lot of journalists, academics, and pundits who have no scientific training are coming out attacking people without actually looking at the evidence, which is very frustrating. Greg Palast called Dr. Jones a fruitcake, and then a month ago apologized for it.
Did he?
It's documented at journalof911studies.com. Under the letters section, Greg Palast officially apologized to Dr. Jones for that. Because you know what? Anytime a journalist comes out and calls people fruitcakes and kooks, if that's the best you can do is call people names, then you're stretching it to call yourself a journalist.
Well, I find a lot of what Dr. Jones has said, not in the research that you're talking about here, but a lot of the other things he's done, highly questionable. So let's deal with it.
I don't know what you're talking about, but let's deal.
Cold fusion?
He's not a cold fusion scientist.
Well, that's not what he calls it.
No, he's not. He's not a cold fusion scientist. He was at the university where those two other folks claimed to use cold fusion. He was not part of that team. There were two other people who basically committed a fraud.
Well, he wasn't Pons and Fleischmann or whatever those guys were.
Yeah, what he's talking about was very different. There's legitimate inquiry, scientific inquiry into this question.
I'm not disagreeing with you, and I'm not disagreeing that fusion is a very forward-thinking way to use to look for energy.
A lot of scientists are investigating this.
It just hasn't been replicable yet.
Right. A lot of scientists have been investigating this, including Dr. Jones. He is not one of the people who perpetrated a fraud in the scientific community.
That's fair. He is also a Mormon. There's nothing wrong with that, but he's been known to end scientific conferences with prayers, which is questionable.
Well, a lot of scientists believe in God. I think it's ridiculous, but you know,
okay,
that's my opinion. But let's not take away from the man as a scientist. His work is top notch. Everything I've seen, his science is top notch. He's very careful. I like the guy.
I'll spend some more time with this, but I still disagree with you about these two photographs. I don't think it shows rust. I don't think that's what he's showing.
Yes.
Maybe you're basing it on the color or something like that, but that's not what it is. I mean,
it is.
He's representing that it's cold. But this is where we disagree.
No offense is intended. No, he says that photograph is consistent with the thermate reaction, which the end product is iron. And
but if it isn't iron,
it is iron. That's rust. That's what rust is.
Okay. All right.
That's seriously.
See, this is where it comes down to. But I thank you very much for coming in today.
Yeah.
This has been very exciting.
It's been good.
And it's been completely interesting the whole time. We didn't have to take any breaks or anything.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure. Let's do it again.
Yes, let's do it again. Let me do some more research and let's do this again.
We'll go back and forth.
Okay. You've been listening to Bennett and Chris here talking about 9/11 on Kill Radio. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.